Once you've gotten to radical acceptance, you have to fight also. What I've realized is it's fighting for a vision. So the way I try to raise the moral thing is not with a wagging finger like you're morally corrupt, as much as I would love to do it in my not good days. But what I try to do is to say things like, in the richest nation on earth, it is wrong that our people can work full time and still have to live in a homeless shelter because they can't afford rent.
That's Simone Campbell, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Simone Campbell from A Nun on the Bus. B.B. King sings, "Nobody likes you but your mama, and she may be jiving you too." A lot of poor people may feel that way. They are stigmatized and demonized. If only they'd go away. What's wrong with them? Can't they find a job or a place to live? The persistence of poverty in the United States, the richest country in history, is a national disgrace. A shanda, as they say in Yiddish. Neoliberal economic policies have produced huge inequality. Who suffers the most? Children. Almost 15 million children were poor in 2015. With more than two-thirds in working families who toil away in our low-growth, low-wage economy. A disproportionate number are Black, Latino, and Native American. There's no money to alleviate poverty, we're told. Are you kidding? There's plenty of dough to enrich the imperial war machine. Some 20 nuns traveled by bus and visited impoverished areas around the country. This is the report from the group's leader. Simone Campbell is a nun and an attorney who works on issues of economic justice, immigration reform, and health care. She belongs to the Sisters of Social Service and is the executive director of the Network Lobby for Catholic Social Justice. She spoke at the Crozier Divinity School in Rochester, New York. And now, Simone Campbell.
Tonight, I am honored to be here in this nest. Isn't this a nest of nourishment? A place where we can come together and breathe a sigh and not look at Facebook posts or Twitter or our news feed or our Instagram or whatever. And we can spend some time tonight reflecting on what is going on in our nation. And hopefully in this process to touch a piece of the anguish of our time, but also to encounter a bit of hope. I picked the question from Ezekiel, can these bones live again? Because so much of what I feel in this political climate as I travel around the country is that so many people are dry, are parched, are disjointed, feel fallen on the ground with hardly anything to connect them. And for me, this question becomes really key when I realized that the early Greek democracy in Athens was a vibrant democracy for about 200 years. And then the rich families started fighting with each other. And once the rich families started fighting with each other, one of the families sold out Athens to Sparta, the warriors. And when you look at what's happening right now in our nation, we've had a vibrant democracy for about 200 years. We have now greater and greater income disparity. We've got rich families fighting each other. And I'm worried, who is Sparta? We also have the military-industrial complex as the way of strength, not the strength of our people. I want to spend some time on just what the state of these bones are, and then where politics calls us in this time of challenge. Yesterday, I was in Indianapolis at a service site where adults are learning, trying to get their GEDs, getting prepared for work. And we had this amazing conversation about what their struggles are. And one woman, Thomasina, just captured my heart. She is struggling to get out of an abusive relationship. She has two children. She herself was so frightened about voting because she told me she was terrified she would do something that would hurt our nation. Seeing all the ads, she just felt it was gonna be bad. And she didn't want to do something bad. She told me that last week she had sold her car for $150. She said it was a clunker. But she sold her car so she would be able to buy her two kids new school clothes, so they would not be made fun of as school started. She was so proud that she could be a good mother to them. But she was so worried about the violence they had already seen in their lives. Her oldest is 9. Her younger child is 7, or almost 7. And these two young folks for her are what keep her going. But she worried about our nation, and that whatever we choose would be bad. I met Angela in Bloomington, Illinois. Angela's a mom, also getting out of an abusive relationship, but she is a Korean immigrant. She married a serviceman and came with him back from Korea to the United States. After they got back here, he became quite controlling, quite abusive. He was having trouble in the military and he was having trouble in the marriage. She finally got away, but her 4-year-old son had witnessed a fair amount of violence. He was speaking at 2, 3, but at 3.5, he quit talking. And she's terrified about what's happening to him. She has a very complicated immigration situation. She doesn't have her permanent residence. She's caught in limbo. It is a mess, and the lawyers are trying to straighten that out. But her big focus and worry is what's happening with her son. He's seen so much violence already at 4 years old. What's happening to him and to her people? Only to discover that in Bloomington, Illinois, it's called Bloomington Normal. I love that a city would be called Normal, but it's not normal at all, because in this metropolitan area, there are no child therapists. There are no child therapists in Bloomington. Her only option to get some care for her son is to take her son to Chicago, an hour and a half away. And she's a low-income mom who can't do it. So she's terrified, but trapped. Thomasina and Angela both are examples of dry bones in our society, where they feel so disconnected and hurt. I met Layla at Vincent Village in Fort Wayne, Indiana. She and her family experienced homelessness, and finally, they have permanent housing. And she was so excited to have permanent housing. And she herself struggles with bipolar disorder, but as long as her medication is balanced, she does really well. But bipolar tears her apart periodically, and she had recently, or the way she lost her apartment before, was by going through an episode that was really extreme. And Layla asked the question, how do you move forward when the cookie cutter has no room for me or my family? That's the challenge that we're facing, is that these disconnected bones are expected to be in a predictable order and a predictable setting, and they're not. The anguish of this time is that we are all separate, laying on the valley floor, trying to pull it back together. On the bus this summer, we went to Cleveland to the Republican convention, which was a wonderful experience, a little terrifying. But when I realized our bones are really, really dry and worrisome was when one of the sisters on the bus said to me, because we were worried about violence in Cleveland, and I asked the sisters to tell me if they were worried about something so we could respond to their concern. And Margaret said to me, well, Simona, I really would like to know what to do if there's an active shooter. I'm not so good at running anymore. And I realized the level of worry and concern in our communities when we're not so good at running anymore. We had a National Security Administration briefing from somebody in the administration. So just in case you want to know, what do you do if you don't run? If you can't run, you're supposed to run, it's the first thing. The second thing is hide, but not in a place where you'll be caught. Which is like, how do you know that when you're in that situation? I'm not quite sure how that works. And then the third thing is, if you can't hide, then you're supposed to attack with loud noise and throw something. Oh, okay. Those sound like really good options. But what I realized was that the anguish of the division and the apprehension that we worry about that, and in the African American community in this time, a week before last, I was in Chicago and we were talking about the level of fearful violence and police problems, and the fear is huge. And we become more and more isolated. Individual dry bones. In St. Louis, I met this group, Mothers to Mothers, and one mom told us that she quizzes her, she's an African-American mom, and she quizzes her sons regularly on what to do when they're stopped by the police, not if, it's when. And what she says is that she drills them so that they keep their hands out of their pockets, their arms away from their body. They say, yes, sir, no, sir, and they don't get any teenage attitude. Now, she has an 8th grader and a 10th grader. And I don't know about you, but by the time I was a 10th grader, I had a lot of teenage attitude. So I don't know how a 10th grader pulls that in. But that's her way of keeping her sons safe. And the week before I met her, Her eighth grader said to her, "Mommy, how long is this going to go on?" And she said she had to look at him and say, "The rest of your life. The rest of your life." She and her sons are dry bones in our valley of our nation that are desperate for something new. And then there's Kathy Dahlkemper up in Erie. You all are pretty close to Erie, though I always forget it's a different state from y'all. But Kathy is the county executive, and she is trying to get better transit for the people in Erie County. And so she pulled together $250,000 to provide to the transit district so the buses will come out into the county out of the city. Sounds like a great plan, doesn't it? But the mayor turned down the money because he doesn't want to lose power over the transit district. And if he accepts money, then maybe his power will be eroded. And so the people suffer. The people walk home from their late night jobs because there's no bus service. Our people are on the floor of the valley, and what are we going to do? And finally, if I'm making you miserable enough, I want to add to this Jason. Jason is an entrepreneur. You would think he would not be a dry bone in the valley, but he is. He's a, he's got probably a couple $1 million and when I met him, and probably has more by now, but he was getting upset that he realized that his taxes, his tax dollars, which he was happy to pay, unlike some other people I could name, that he was getting upset that his tax dollars were going to fund his competitors. And I said to him, "What? Your tax dollars are funding your competitors?" And he says, "Yes." He, Jason, pays all of his workers a living wage. His competitors don't. And so the low-wage workers have to use the social safety net to survive. They use food stamps, Medicaid, housing vouchers. And what Jason had realized is that his tax dollars were funding the safety net. Now, he said he was happy to provide a robust safety net for people who fell on hard times. But what was making him angry was that his competitors could outbid him because they had lower personnel costs because they paid low wages. See how that works? So Jason was saying everyone should pay a living wage and the safety net should not be a business subsidy. Then I talked to other business people about Jason's worry. And Jason, and this one guy said to me, "Oh, Sister Simone, that's really nice that you're worried about it. Very nice. But we have pressure from the financial sector to have a high profit. And if we don't have a high profit, we lose our investors. And so if you want me to reduce my profit by paying better wages, you have to make me do it. We need a law." We've tried to get a law in Congress, and they say it's a job killer. It's not a job killer. But because we're so separate, so torn apart, such dry bones in the valley of our nation at this moment, we don't see how we need to be woven back together again. Can these bones live again? As I was thinking about this, I have tried to figure out, how did we get in this mess? Do you ever wonder about that? I have a lot of theories, but the one that I can really point to, unfortunately, you know, I'm a Californian, and I hate to say this, but it was our two presidents that we've exported from California. Neither one has been real stellar, so I'm sorry, I apologize, but we sort of shipped them out. But Ronald Reagan changed how we think of our founding story as a nation. I think Ronald Reagan started the drift towards making us all these dry bones in this valley when he had this great ad about the one man riding on a horse into the West to settle the West. The West was settled by one strong man. I watched television as a kid, and I know that it was wagon trains that went west. It wasn't a single individual riding off into the West that settled the West. It was community. But what he did was change the narrative so it was that we were settled by the pioneer man being strong. Well, if you only had one guy or one wagon and you were in trouble and you yelled, "Circle the wagons," and you only have one of them, it's not going to work. Or if you've got a barn raising and only one person shows up to raise a barn, it's not going to work. Or, and this I know from personal experience, if you're trying to make a quilt for the winter and you try to do it by yourself like I tried to do, it was the most ridiculous thing I ever did. 5 years in, I decided I would invite my friends over for a quilting debee to finish the blessed thing. It only took us one additional year, but it got done. But you can't do these things by yourself. Our nation is founded not on strong individuals riding off into the sunset. Our nation is founded on we the people. We are community, and we need to reclaim it. The dry bones that lay on the floor of our political valley in this moment, I think, are the result of excessive individualism. An excessive individualism that says, my bone is alone and I'm special and I'm not connected to anyone. It's wrong. But in our certitude, in our determination to be individualistic, we're laying there on the valley floor rather than pursuing rising up together. And our wealth as a nation perpetuates this myth that we can go it alone. I did a business roundtable in Chicago. It's about a year and a half ago now, and because I wanted to learn what does business need for the common good and what do they contribute to the common good. And it had just come out that the average salary for a CEO of a publicly traded company was $10 million a year. And they were going for $11 million. So I got to say to these entrepreneurs sitting around the table, well, guys, and they were all guys, don't, no offense to the guys, is it that you're not getting by on $10 million, that you just need a little extra mil? And this one guy said to me, oh no, Sister Simone, it's not about the money. It's not about the money? Well, you could have fooled me. He said, no. The thing is, we're very competitive and we want to win. It just happens that the measure of winning is money. Wow. The measure of winning is how big is my salary. The measure of winning is how much of an endowment do we have. The measure of winning is dollar signs in our current society. And that competitiveness is leaving us dry on the valley floor when we win at the expense of another bone laying right next to me who I don't even see. And as I've thought about this, praying about these dry bones, because in many ways those that are angry are most dry, and what I realized was that I believe, this is my theory, so I have no idea if there's data for it, but I believe that the reason they're angry is because they actually were fooled by party politics that were against their interests. They've suffered over the past years because of it, but rather than being able to own the fact that they were duped, they lash out at people who look different, and that they claim it's their fault. And the hardest part is to turn that pointing finger at ourselves and say, I'm part of the problem. I was fooled. Oh, glory. So we are in this mess of isolation, blame, anger, walking up and down among those rattling bones, and it's driving me nuts. Can these bones live again? What are the protective sinews that can pull us back together? How can we find a way forward in this vast wasteland of our nation at this moment? How do we not just turn off the television, disconnect from the world, and stay in our comfortable nest? It's nice here, isn't it? It's great singing, it's beautiful, it uplifts my spirit, so let's stay. But where we're called to is to walk up and down that valley. And as I walk up and down the valley, I want to give you some glimpses of sinews that are beginning to connect bones. In Little Rock, Arkansas, or it might have been Nashville, and I'm a little forgetful, but I think it was Little Rock, we did we were on the bus last fall, and we did a town hall. And this one, we had tables, round tables, and this one group sat together, introduced themselves. And this group of seven people discovered they all lived in the same neighborhood, but they didn't know each other. And they were shocked. How could we live within three blocks of each other but not know each other? So they did a little problem solving. How did that happen? And what they realized, what they said to the group was, this is how they became dry bones. They had a garage attached to a house. They had an automatic garage door opener. They had air conditioning in the house. And they had a private backyard with a swimming pool. And because of that, they never saw their neighbors, because they had everything they needed to be special. So you know what they did? They decided that they were going to start sitting on their front porches, waving at people as they went by. They had no idea if it was going to make a difference, but they wanted to at least know people's faces.
You're listening to Simone Campbell from A Nun on the Bus. This is Alternative Radio, celebrating more than 30 years of independent broadcasting. You can order copies of this program by calling us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org.
In another town we were in, we met a group of people who lived on the other side of the tracks. Actually, it was the other side of the freeway. And they had we were there in September. So in March, they had driven around to the wealthy areas to see what the wealthy areas had that their neighborhood did not have. And they came back with a long list of what they needed. They needed street lights, street signs, they needed curbs, they needed sidewalks, they had this long list. And then the question was, where do we start? What do we do first? You know what they decided to do first? They decided to plant flowers and vegetables in the front yard of the various houses on the street. It was actually a couple of blocks. I think it was like three blocks. And then in the summertime, when the vegetables were growing and the flowers were blooming, they invited the mayor down. And the mayor saw a neighborhood that was taking care of itself. And they asked then for the streetlights, the sidewalks, the curbs, the street signs. And we saw the mayor, and the mayor said they were very effective. We're getting them the sidewalks first, and in the next budget, we're going to try to put in the other things because this neighborhood cares. It's weaving together where we do things together. It's a basic attitude that we are in this together. So, what do we do in the midst of this? Well, I have a quote from Pope Francis. What is needed is a politics which is far-sighted and capable of a new, integral and interdisciplinary approach to handling the different aspects of the crises of our world. He goes on to say, a strategy for real change calls for rethinking processes in their entirety. For it is not enough to include a few superficial ideas, while failing to question the logic which underlies present-day culture. We have got to examine this culture of individualism, the culture of money as the measure of winning, the culture that says I can say anything I want against anyone else. I can have an anger that I can exhibit without restraint. When we walk through the valley of the dry bones, we need to know we have to look deeper, breathe more deeply, and prophesy to those bones. Prophesy to the bones to come together, be connected, live in this time in a way that we have not done for quite a while. We need each other. It is not possible to have these bones live and not be connected to everyone. That is the challenge that we face. And so as we do this, we have a serious responsibility, those of us that share faith. Because the faith that leads us to the place of seeing Thomasina and her struggle for her kids, seeing Angela and her worry for her four-year-old, seeing the struggles that exist here in Rochester, and seeing the fact that Layla doesn't have to fit in a cookie cutter. Seeing that those in the Republican Party were really grim and had such a hard time creating hope or thinking of what could bring them hope. We have a responsibility to all of these. And so what I think tonight is about is to acknowledge that we're sinews, that we're connected, that we're engaged, that the only way that these bones can live again is if we reach out, if we touch where the pain is, if we embrace those who are weeping, if we weep with those who weep, if we let our hearts be broken open. Because the thing I've discovered is when my heart is broken open, there's room for everyone. No one can be left out of my care. Even some politicians that I'd like to vote off the island, we continue to have to care for. Because the fact is, the only way the bones will live is if we acknowledge that we are connected. And when we have eyes to see the sinews and the connection, then we can stand up and the breath of the Spirit will again revive us. That is our challenge. That is my hope. And so to close, and then we'll open it up for conversation, I want to read one of my poems. I wrote it in Iraq, actually. In 2002, I went on a delegation to Iraq, and it was in December before we invaded, and that night, the last night we were in Baghdad, it's so funny. The last night we were in Baghdad, we had gone to an Italian restaurant. Partially because we knew it had a generator so they would have hot food. But when we came back, there was a wedding party in the light from the plate glass window of our hotel. And there, we watched the folk dancing going on. There was this accordion and a screechy old violin. And we got drawn into dancing. And this guy, stood about this tall, leans over and says to me, as he's trying to show me the folk dance, he says to me, "How long do my niece and her new husband have to live in peace? How long until you start bombing us?" That night, it was so visceral for me that we are one body. This is the poem that was given. It's called Incarnation, and it's my prayer for us that these bones might come together. And it goes like this. Let gratitude be the beat of our hearts, pounding Baghdad rhythms, circulating memories, meaning of this journey. Let resolve flow in our veins, fueled by Basra's destitution, risking reflective action in a 15-second world. Let compassion be our hands, reaching to be with each other, all others, to touch, hold, heal this fractured world. Let wisdom be our feet, bringing us to the crying need, to friends or foe, to share this body's blood. And let love be our eyes, that we might see the beauty, see the dream, lurking in the shadows of despair and dread. And let community be our body warmth, radiating Arab energy to welcome in the foreign stranger, even the ones who wage this war. And let us remember on drear, distant days. We live as one, this tragic, gifted life.
I heard Glenn Beck, and I liked what Glenn Beck said, and I want to say what he said and see what you think. First of all, he had warned about the alt-right, so he was concerned about that. But he said about the state of society is that we're at a moment where we need a Martin Luther King or a Gandhi. And there's no Martin Luther King or Gandhi at the national level, so therefore it devolves back to the local level for us to come together. And he said the prevailing words are win-win, but what it should be is reconciliation. Are there other, and I'm also, I'm not saying this as an answer, but if you could talk about the higher moral ground movement, Forbes, if that's part of what might be happening. So what about these local movements that should be happening?
There is a lack of innovative thought at the national level. And there is a lack of innovative leadership. You know, we're desperate for a leader that will stand up. The local areas, it's not the most flattering way to describe it, but I think local areas are petri dishes of new possibilities. You're trying new things out. We desperately need innovation and new ideas and new ways of coming together and breaking it open. Let me give you an example. We were in Asheville, North Carolina, and they had passed a living wage ordinance. The state legislature, which is, you know some of the trouble in North Carolina, the state legislature took away their authority to pass that kind of law. But you know what Asheville did? Asheville didn't, I mean, they went and complained and protested and all this stuff. But they also then said, all right, what else can we do? So the nonprofits went together to certify businesses in Asheville that were paying a living wage. And then they went to the newspaper and got the newspaper, I believe it's every month, to publish the list of businesses that are paying a living wage and run an ad saying, support these good businesses. By the time we were there, it's a year and a half ago now, there were over 400 businesses certified as paying a living wage. But see, it was the creativity of when one door closed, it's not being stopped by it. But the urgent need of these bones to come together are urgent enough that we'll find another way. And only that can be done at the local level. We need you to do that. So don't get stopped, get determined.
What is the mindset of people who purport to follow Jesus and yet they feel that the individual approach is the right approach for them in the future of this country?
Oh, yes. I wanted to include brain transplants in the Affordable Care Act because they annoy me, but it is true. Paul Ryan is a great example of that. He takes his faith seriously, he says, but he defines subsidiarity as individualism. And he believes that it's his responsibility to care for himself and his family without help. He does not get that we are a community to share a communal concern. I think his community stops at his front door. I have encouraged him to come, what I call, come meet my people, so that he knows how he is connected. Well, but he told me he'd been to an African American church, and then I checked up on him, and yes, he went to an African-American church on a Sunday morning. He sat in the front row and he didn't talk to anybody. He's very awkward. He's very shy in some ways. And he needs the bravado of position and the distance that notoriety gives him. He's not good at talking one-on-one with somebody who's not powerful. And so my compassion for him is trying to acknowledge his awkwardness and trying to lure him into more relationship. Because the fact is, usually it's fear or a sense of insecurity that causes this desire for individualism. The other piece is this idea of the prosperity gospel that's very strong, especially in the southern part of our nation. When we were on the bus in the south, it was shocking to see these signs about, if you're loved by God, you'll be blessed with riches. Which then says that if you're not rich, you're not loved. And that's where we have to be stronger than that and become missionaries for the love that these people are so hungry for. I mean, it's anguish. And the other piece is, let's just be real about it. There are a whole bunch of people that have made a lot of money and are very happy, and money is the measure of winning, and so they've won, and they like winning. So part of it is trying to erode that reality.
My question is, in terms of the levels of you've described, we talked about the three women, and you talked about the person that's the entrepreneur, and you talked about these gentlemen at the table. And generally, the concept of moral injury has been used as a broad military term. But if you look at what you describe, the issue of moral injury is affecting all those people you're talking about. Ooh. And not only that, if we think about it deep enough, that moral injury in terms of those gentlemen at the table, their competitiveness is really affecting and causing a lot of problems. Yeah. That they might not understand in terms of individualism, where not only moral injury becomes an injury, but it becomes a pathology. And I think we need to look at that more. Mm-hmm. And in terms of community awareness and discussion, and talk about how we identify those issues, not trying to hijack from the military moral injury, but how to use it as a mechanism for healing. Yeah. And just to open up, you know, because we keep open up, pulling scabs off our wounds.
Yeah.
We need to let that heal.
Yeah.
So.
Good point. Thank you for bringing that up. Because, well, let me tell you the problem. The problem is that the contemplative life, to be alive in the spirit, requires radical acceptance. A radical acceptance of everybody, even the ones that annoy me. So even though I want to vote them off the island, I have to accept them, like my conversation about Paul Ryan. That's what I'm trying to do. But then there's also, once you've gotten to radical acceptance, you have to fight also. What I've realized is it's fighting for a vision. So the way I try to raise the moral thing is not with a wagging finger like, you're morally corrupt, as much as I would love to do it in my not good days. But what I try to do is to say things like, in the richest nation on earth, it is wrong that our people can work full time and still have to live in a homeless shelter because they can't afford rent. Okay? But it's wrong because of the context. And so we fight for a vision where everyone, where all these bones can come together. See the difference? Yeah. But we need a moral voice. I was also at the Ford Foundation. I have all these experiences. Kind of join, you know, lead a quiet life, join the convent. That's my recommendation. So I was at the Ford Foundation, and we were talking about faith and public policy. And one of the higher-ups in the foundation asked this very interesting question. He acknowledged that we need moral language in this time, which goes back to the lack of national leaders. We need moral language in this time, but how does a progressive movement that doesn't have faith create a moral language? And I thought that was a really interesting insight.
So to go back to your Homeland Security briefing, where they said in an active shooter you run and then you hide and then you throw things and scream, what do we throw?
Well, I'll tell you what we've done at Network, because I'm seriously concerned about the rise of hate speech and the parallels between 1930s in Germany and this are horrifying. And so I got really worried that institutional folks were taking a pass because it was political. And so we started a bigotry watch. And so what we're doing is we're using social media. We do press releases. We try to get more in the press, but try to be bold and say, stop it. This isn't politics. This is humanity. It's not about being politically correct. It's about being human. Being human requires us to embrace everyone and not create hate and divisions. Stop it. So that's what we're trying. But I really think faith folks are called in this time to stand up to it. But it's not happening a lot. And often what we do as faith people is we couch it in ever-loving, thoughtful ways about not wanting to hurt anybody, and we're not going to really, so we never really say what we mean, which goes back to the moral piece. I guess I may be better at it than I think I am. But it's that clarity. Stop it. The challenge is we think of ourselves individually, and in the individual, then I ought to be with people who like me, who agree with me, who get along with me. But what you have to know about Wisconsin is that Janesville, where Paul Ryan is from, part of the town is represented by Paul Ryan. Part of it is represented by Mark Pocan. Paul Ryan, as we know, is a Speaker of the House. He's a Republican, conservative. Mark Pocan is a Democrat and a member of the Progressive Caucus. So two guys with very different perspectives got elected by the territory around this one town. So it's not that we have to wipe Wisconsin off the map, so it would neaten up the border. Or as what I do, my sin is that I think global warming, lose Florida, wouldn't be so bad, would it? The challenge is if we are one body, then our faith challenges us to include everybody in our care, regardless of how nutty they are. So at the Republican convention, I think I got sidetracked on telling you my Republican convention story. At the Republican convention, we asked three questions. We interviewed people. We did the same thing at Democrats. We asked three questions. Who in your family is it difficult to talk to about politics and why? Now, at the Republican convention, they said, oh, those Democrats, oh, they're just impossible. And at the Democratic convention, they said, oh, those Republicans, you know, every family has one, it's a real problem. But then we said, the second question was, what worries you in this election cycle? And many of the delegates told us that what worried them was that there wasn't a good choice for president. Many of the Bernie supporters in Philadelphia told us what worried them was there wasn't a good choice for president. The biggest difference was the third question. When asking Republicans, what gives you hope for our nation? A lot of them had hopes, but a fair number of them would go, And this one guy said to me, the Constitution? As if there was a right answer, and did he get it right? Now, the difference was at the Democratic convention, while the other first two were quite similar, everybody had some hope. Everybody could point to something. Everybody could say, oh, this is happening, or that's happening, or, you know, this idea, or that idea, or, you know, making progress, or, you know, the Affordable Care Act gives me hope that we're going to get to single payer, or, you know, those kinds of things. But what I realized was that when a party is fueled by anger, it suppresses hope. And if we don't have hope, we don't have a vision. And if we don't have a vision, then we're dry bones in the valley. Thank you so much.
That was Simone Campbell from A Nun on the Bus. She spoke at the Crozier Divinity School in Rochester, New York. Simone Campbell is a nun and an attorney who works on issues of economic justice, immigration reform, and health care. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado, celebrating more than 30 years of independent broadcasting. We cover issues ignored or distorted by the mainstream media. We can do that because of support from individuals just like you. We have a series of programs on inequality, race, class, and the ongoing economic crisis. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs, MP3s, or written transcripts of today's program, Simone Campbell from A Nun on the Bus, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. The Kronos Quartet performs our theme music. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.